This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and as we work to gain perspective during this crisis, we may find ourselves searching our personal or collective memories for precedents, stories, or myths that might restore at least some of the ground under our feet. And as we have just seen, while we may be in this together, various communities are experiencing the pandemic in different ways. What's the relationship between collective memory and identity? Myths like the American Dream or the Lost Cause emerge from selective memory. They exclude Native and Black communities from history-making authority. Melinda Maynor Lowry is with us today. She's a professor of history and the director of the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Melinda, welcome back to The State of Things. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to hear your voice.
It's nice to hear yours. How are you doing?
Leaning into this this roller coaster that we're on that doesn't seem to have a discernible end.
No, it's, so. Yeah. Just leaning into it, what does that mean? What do you mean?
Well, for me, I guess it means that the first 2 weeks of stay-at-home orders and working from home and so forth felt like, oh, this is a refreshing break. But that sense of sort of security has not continued. And in some ways, the sense of security has gotten worse rather than better. Partly because I've been sick myself, fortunately not with COVID, but I was able to get a test and that was fantastic news to me. So the good news of that whole experience was that, talking to a nurse at Duke, going to the clinic to get tested. Folks were friendly. I hadn't seen any hand sanitizer in weeks and weeks, and they had it. They gave me a mask. They gave me things that I could have stocked up on, I think, if I had understood that this was coming.
So,
but I had some bronchial issues, so not COVID.
Feeling better now. So hand sanitizers and masks, the little things that help get us through. Anything else? Are you reading anything, watching anything that's kind of helping you put this in perspective?
Well, for me, my reference right now is The Parable of the Sower, novel by Octavia Butler, that she issued in 1993, and it depicts a future time of 2027. Which seems a lot closer now than it did. And it also, you know, tells about a young woman on a journey after the collapse of her family and her society to recreate a new community. And one of the factors in that collapse, of course, was disease, warfare, the failure of government to secure the futures of vulnerable people, like we've just been hearing about. And so what Octavia Butler writes about in that novel has been a constant, not so much a source of comfort, perhaps, but a source of perspective and reflection. And the way that the protagonist conducts her journey, the relationships that she builds, is a useful reminder for me to continue to show the relationships that I have and get my priorities straight.
Would you read a passage for us?
Sure.
This is a book, by the way. It is set in the year 2027, which, as you say, not far, but written published anyway in 1993. So, and it talks about, you know, as you say, environmental collapse, social collapse, the failure to take care of vulnerable populations, political division and collapse, the collapse of an empire. So very familiar stuff. But anyway, I don't know. I just love to hear what you're reading these days.
Eerily familiar, yeah. And so this passage, it follows an argument between, the protagonist's name is Lauren, between her parents about how to defend their neighborhood against thieves that are using violence to steal precious resources and terrorize residents. And so kind of entering in the middle of the argument with her dad's voice. You want to trust them not to hurt you or the kids just because there are seven of us? Baby, we can't live by pretending this is still 20 or 30 years ago. But you could go to jail. She was crying, not sobbing, but speaking with that voice full of tears that she can manage sometimes. No, Dad said. If we have to shoot someone, we're together in it. After we've shot him, we carry him into the nearest house. It's still legal to shoot housebreakers. After that, we do a little damage and get our story straight. Long, long silence. You could still get in trouble. I'll risk it. Another long silence. Thou shalt not kill, Corey whispered. Nehemiah 4, Dad said, verse 14. There was nothing more. A few minutes later, I heard Dad leave. I waited until I heard Corey go to her room and shut the door. Then I got up, shut my door, moved my lamp so the light wouldn't show under the door, then turned it on and opened my grandmother's Bible. She had had a lot of Bibles, and Dad had let me keep this one. Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 14. And I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people, be not afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons, and your daughters, your wives, and your houses.
Melinda Maynor Lowry reading from Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, a book published in 1993. What speaks to you in that passage? Because it certainly, I connect with even your own family who can connect very closely to that Nehemiah quote, protect your families, do what it takes.
Yeah. I read my grandmother's Bible. I have one of her Bibles, and she had a brother named Nehemiah. there's many prophets, you know, in our society, and many of them go unheard or ignored because we're so absorbed by commercial enterprises and the consumer economy that is intent upon distracting us so that a few people can make more money. That the true prophets, the ones that are speaking to what we should do at this moment and into the future, are just crowded out. Nehemiah was one of those, and I have ancestors who were like that too. My great 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 three times great grandfather was a man named Alan Lowry, and he was killed by a white mob in 1865 at the end of the Civil War, after his family had alienated members of the Confederacy and in particular the Confederate Home Guard by maintaining loyalty to the Union. And there were rumors that Allen and his sons, he had 12 sons, were mounting an insurrection using weapons that by state law they were not allowed to carry. And after a series of events, Allen and his eldest son, William, were killed by this mob. His youngest son, a man named Henry Barry Lowry, was about 18 at the time. And Henry Barry became the leader of a gang of Indians who were his cousins, his brothers-in-law, his brothers, but also black neighbors and white neighbors who were all determined to resist the oppression that they had finally had enough of. So Alan is the kind of Nehemiah in that story. You know, he had obviously raised his children and taken inspiration from his own ancestors to rise up, to fight, to protect. And the Bible tells us a couple of different things. You know, the 10th commandment, the sacred commandment is thou shalt not kill. But Nehemiah says, listen, you know, you can't afford to avoid self-defense. And so that's what Lauren's family was going through in Parable of the Sower. That's what so many of my ancestors have gone through over the years. And I think it's literally what our families today are doing, often not with guns necessarily, but they're fighting in lots and lots of different ways.
Well, and more recently, Lumbee resistance to the Ku Klux Klan in the 1950s.
Yeah, that's another kind of, there's lots of historical parallels. You know, one of the things that we have done as a community is to maintain a really solid understanding of our territory, of our land, of our place, and what we claim and own as a sovereign community. And so, you know, Henry Barry was one in a long line of people who
rose up to defend that territory and the people who lived there. And, you know, that just activity just hasn't stopped. You know, it goes way back to the 18th century in terms of recorded history. It goes well forward into the civil rights movement, and you see examples of it today.
You know, it's interesting. You think about, you know, why would anybody want to read Octavia Butler's story about the collapse of an empire and the post-apocalyptic world? But the parable of the sower, the one that comes out of the Christian spiritual tradition, the one that Jesus spoke, and the one I think made reference to in the title of Octavia Butler's novel, talks about unheeded, all of that seed that gets spread and either gets eaten up or swallowed up or never takes root or takes root too shallowly and never doesn't really produce fruit. But there is a fraction of it that finds fertile ground and produces fruit. And I think maybe that's I'm asking, is that the comfort you find in this, that there is, even among the fraction who will listen, hope that there is a fruitful outcome?
Yeah, I think it's all the sowers that matter, too. The Apostle Paul, I think, talked about the importance of the sowers, not just the fruit. There is the fruit, and the fruit is what nourishes us. But those who are willing to sow, even when they know the rewards are not tangible or could fail, that the seeds might not take root, are the ones who consistently inspire me. And so I think when we focus too much on the fruit or the, we tend to think of scarcity, you know, the scarcity of the fruit is one way to interpret that parable. The other way to interpret that parable as Paul did much, much later was the kind of growth mentality of the sower.
And I think
that's kind of what gets me through, is thinking about how do we grow through challenges.
And I guess then the complexity of it all, if you're just going to scatter seed wildly, it means that, you know, even with the story of Henry Berry and some of the others who use violence and become a gang, and it's a complicated history. It's not first of all, the Lumbee presence in North Carolina complicates the racial dyad that had been the law of the land. And so I guess maybe expecting and being comfortable with the complexity of it all, the outcomes that you may not even as a sower, you may not expect. Is that part of what you're looking at?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's why I love history so much, is because while you can certainly learn lessons from history, the best lessons are not the simple ones. The best lessons are the ones that help us appreciate the messiness of our ancestors and therefore the messiness of our own lives. There just aren't, you know, there aren't perfect people. Nobody is a saint or certainly not our historical figures. And so to make someone like Henry Barry Lowry or his father, Allen, into a legend that, you know, that's been kind of emphasized, his Robin Hood actions, Robin Hood style actions. One of the things that he did to help us, our community, survive these tragedies, including disease, was to take from those who were hoarding food and redistribute it to those who had no food. And, you know, we can call on the British story of Robin Hood to make a comparison, but that only serves to oversimplify the context in which Henry Barry made those actions. You know, I think he and a lot of the criminal activity that resulted from the Lowry gang's fight against the Confederacy and their successors, the Democrats, the so-called Party of White Supremacy, you know, a lot of people died in that conflict. A lot of people who suffered, who were innocent, who were blameless in that conflict. And to oversimplify Henry Barry as a kind of outlaw legend means that we miss the larger significance of his movement, which is that it took place within a context of social and familial tribal relations that had boundaries and expectations. And so there are certain things that Henry Barry did that reflect those relationships. So, for example, he unintentionally, or one member of his crew unintentionally killed a young man who was a member of the militia that were hunting them in around 1870. And because he did not mean to kill this individual, and because the individual's father had been a friend of the Lowrys over the years, Henry Berry himself went to personally apologize to the man's father for killing his son. When he would steal food from a plantation, he would return the planter's wagon after redistributing the food throughout the Lumbee and white and black community. So those kinds of examples are things that, you know, sound like a hero, something a hero would do. But Henry Berry was just operating within the standard expectations of his mother, his aunts, the people who were in charge of his socialization and told him what to do. So we always have to see these folks in the context of their community and the relationships that they had. When we oversimplify, we just miss the importance of what we can do with that history now.
Melinda, if I only gave you 20 seconds, can you tell me who are the sewers who are inspiring you right now?
I think it's the teachers. It's the artists. It's the people like Toshi Reagan this afternoon making her concert for Parable of the Sower available on Facebook Live. These are the healers in our community. And I think in particular, of course, our medical professionals, our frontline folks, they're sowing. They don't know what the reward is going to be or what fruit will be reaped, but they continue to work tirelessly, selflessly, and provide us with some sense of perspective and context.
Melinda Maynard Lowry, a professor of history, director of the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill. Melinda, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.